Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening, this is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Nancy Cooper is missing. Her husband said she went for a jog and never came home. Hundreds search for the vivacious mother of two young girls in the upscale North Carolina neighborhood. Days later, Nancy's body is discovered face down in a ditch a few miles from her home. It appears she's been snatched off a jogging trail and strangled. Yet focus immediately falls on Nancy's smart, athletic, and handsome husband, Brad, because the couple had been embroiled in a violently contentious divorce. Brad Cooper steadfastly maintains his innocence. Nancy's loved one knows of Brad's lies and his cheating. They know he wielded an unhealthy control over his wife. They feared with good reason that the strong-willed Nancy was ultimately no match for her husband's dark side. As the story unfolds in this peaceful suburb, secrets are revealed, families are torn apart, and a trail of damning evidence paves the path to final justice. The book that's featured this evening is Love Lies, a true story of marriage and murder in the suburbs, with my special guest, journalist and author Amanda Lamb. Thank you for agreeing to this program, and welcome back to True Murder, Amanda Lamb.
Thank you, Dan. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Now, tell us a little bit about where exactly this crime occurred. I know that we're dealing with North Carolina, and we're dealing with Raleigh,
sure.
North Carolina, but is this a suburb, or tell us what
is.
Cary, North Carolina is.
Cary is really the closest suburb to Raleigh. It's a middle, upper-class suburb, a bedroom community. People who were familiar with this area maybe 20 years ago would have called it a crossroads, and now this crossroads has turned into a town of, you know, more than 120,000 people. So it's really almost a small city, but it's very suburban. It's a sprawling suburb with, you know, manicured lawns and walking paths, and, you know, you drive around and you see kids on their bikes and people walking their dogs and jogging, and it's just a very serene, quiet, nice community with very, very low crime rates. So that was one of the reasons that this case really captured everybody's attention almost immediately.
Okay, let's start with who Nancy Cooper was, her early life, her parents. She grew up in Edmonton, I believe, or at least that's...
She did.
There is
she
a Canadian connection.
Edmonton. Yes, she grew up in Edmonton, and she met her husband, Brad, in Canada. He's also a Canadian. He's from a small town called Medicine Hat. And at the time, both of them were kind of starting out in their early professional careers. Brad was in information technology, and Nancy was also doing some work in that area, and they were working at the same company. They met. They started dating. Actually, Nancy had tried to fix Brad up with one of her friends and then decided that she liked him and that they were more suited for each other. And it's a fairly quick romance. I mean, they met. She had been in a long-term relationship prior to that with somebody else as well as he had. They met and within a few months decided they were going to get married. They were planning a wedding for sometime down the road, maybe a year down the road. And as it ended up, Brad got a job in North Carolina with a very large technology company called Cisco Systems. And so as a result, he was planning to move to North Carolina. And so he and Nancy immediately sped up their marriage plans and just had a very, very quick wedding, really with just Nancy's family and close friends. His parents did not even attend. They were living in another area at the time. And then Brad moved to North Carolina, and Nancy followed very quickly after that. And when they moved to North Carolina, they immediately moved to this area in Cary, which, as you know, suburbs are not walking areas. They're not areas that are, you know, adjacent to public transportation or to shopping areas. I mean, you have to have a car. So that was kind of one of their first sticking points, is that they didn't have the finances for both of them to have a vehicle. And so soon after they moved to North Carolina, they started talking about having a family, and eventually they did have two little girls. And for a long time, I think most people who knew them would have said, you know, they were living what most people thought was the American dream. I mean, they lived in a nice house. They lived in a nice neighborhood. They had lots of friends. They had two beautiful daughters. They were both very athletic, both into running. Brad Cooper did Ironman, you know, triathlons, and Nancy was training for a marathon. And so from the outside, they looked like they were doing well. But as we learned more about them and learned more about their marriage, that clearly was not the case.
Now, let's go back for our audience a little bit, because you do obviously paint the, you know, a character portrait of these people. Tell us a little bit about Brad Cooper. Tell us about his early life, if there was any indication whatsoever, except that he would be an exceptionally gifted person, very intelligent guy, good-looking guy, athletic guy, seemed to be quite charming. Tell us a little bit about Brad Cooper in his early life, and tell us what his family life was really like, and if there was any indication of what did happen later.
What we know about Brad Cooper is very limited, because he and his family have been very private throughout this whole ordeal. And so most of what we know comes from a deposition that he sat for in the custody case that involved their children after the murder. And he talked about, you know, growing up in this small town. His father worked at the university. He was a very accomplished, very bright man, and had pushed Brad to achieve things in his life, and Brad had followed suit. He had one brother, and it seems like from everything he talked about that there wasn't a lot of communication amongst his family members, that they were very quiet, very reserved, and that carried into his adult life from the understanding that we have from the people that testified in the case and also were involved in filing affidavits in the custody case. And they basically just talked about this stark contrast between Brad Cooper and Nancy Cooper, which was that Brad was just a very quiet, very reserved person. Again, as you mentioned, clearly very intelligent and also quite talented athlete, but a very reserved person. And Nancy was quite the opposite. I think I've heard her referred to as body saucy. She had a great kind of crazy sense of humor that people enjoyed. She was the life of the party, very outgoing, very, very outgoing. Lots of friends. Was the kind of person that every time she met somebody, they became a new friend. And so Brad's personality seemed to be the polar opposite and really a stark contrast to Nancy's. And, you know, that may have contributed clearly to some of the problems in their marriage. But no indication of any, I mean, he had no past criminal record, no history of violence. There were some allegations that he did have some problems with depression and that he may have been suicidal. He himself, in his deposition, said that was not the case, but those were some allegations from Nancy's family during the custody case, that they felt that he did have some issues with depression.
Now, before we get too far into this, too, maybe you can tell us a little bit about Nancy Cooper's life, because you did have contact with the parents,
mm-hmm.
Donna Rentz and Gary Rentz, and tell us a little bit about her life, because I think it's important, because we'll talk about the custody battle, and then, of course, they're even important in the trial itself. But tell us about Donna Rentz and Gary Rentz and Nancy's life growing up in Canada, in Edmonton, a fairly big city in Canada.
Right. Well, I had a lot more access to Nancy's family, so I definitely have a lot more information about the Rentzes. But Nancy came from large, by today's standards, four children, a large, loving family, a family that loved to be together, loved to do things together. They traveled together. They played games together. They were all very involved in each other's lives. And the stories of growing up were amazing because you really got a sense of this close-knit family that whenever somebody new came in, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a spouse, they were just kind of welcomed into this family and found a place there and really fell in love with this family. And I think Brad Cooper fell in love with this family, and I know that they had welcomed him with open arms, even though he was very different from Nancy, because that's just the kind of people they were. Nancy, Donna and Gary Runtz are very bright. They own their own business. Gary has worked in the past. He did work in child welfare in Canada, so he did have some background, and that helped him when he got involved in the custody case. But all of the children and their children come home frequently, and they all, again, vacation together and spend time together. And that was, there were just many, many, many stories they shared with me like that. Nancy was an identical twin. Her sister Krista Lister is now raising her children. And she had an older brother, Jeff, who is a police officer. And she also had a younger sister, Jill. And so as I got to know them, I realized that they really were genuinely the kind of people that were open-minded and welcomed people into their home and into their family. And again, that's what they did with Brad Cooper. So losing Nancy was literally like losing, as Jeff said, it was like there's a spoke missing in our wheel. And I think for any parent that's ever lost a child, it's really like losing your arm or losing your leg. It's something that you can't imagine living without, and yet somehow right. you do. But just pretty amazing people and very gracious and very reserved in that they did not lash out in anger when they could have with many, many television cameras in their face. They chose their words very carefully, and they chose to concentrate on the positive, which was all the support they received from the community and also from the investigators involved in the case.
Okay, now let's get back to the marriage. And you say that they had a sort of a quiet wedding, and his parents didn't show up. I found that family didn't show up at the wedding. For whatever reason, I found that a little bit odd. But now, at what point and how many years have they been married? Because we're talking about 2008 here. When do these problems surface that they have in their marriage, and what exactly specifically are the kinds of issues that are presenting themselves as problems in the marriage from what you've researched?
Well, my understanding is that early on in the marriage, the transportation issue was really one of the first sticking points, which was that they had moved to this suburban community and Nancy had no transportation. She had no way to go to the grocery store, to go shopping, to go see a friend. She also had no visa, so she couldn't work. So there was a kind of an immediate sense of being trapped in a way, because right. she was a woman who had worked, had a college degree. She had owned her own store at one time. She had had professional jobs in Canada. And all of a sudden, she was living in the suburbs of Raleigh, North Carolina, with no job and no transportation. So if you ask family members, they will say that the cracks started to show in their relationship very early in the marriage. And to the point where Nancy had actually come home, I think it was in the first year of marriage, if I recall, and said, I don't want to do this anymore. And the family had talked to her and convinced her to basically give it another try. And Brad had, in fact, come back to Canada and asked her to give the marriage another try. He was working a lot. And so, again, she was left at home alone with very few friends at that time. She really hadn't connected with people and had no transportation. What I'm told by the family is that things were rocky, and then as soon as she had her first child, a daughter named Bella, things really started to improve because Nancy had always wanted to be a mother, and that was really one of her biggest goals in life. And one of the really the impetus for marrying Brad very quickly, because at the time she had been involved in Canada with a man prior to Brad who she was very much in love with, but he was older and had older children and did not apparently want to have more children. but right. she knew Brad wanted to have a family. So again, there was this desire to have a family. She had this daughter, and things started to improve. Then they had the second child, and that's when things started to go downhill. And specifically, Nancy started to hear stories about Brad being unfaithful to her. And one of those stories was actually that it was one of her very close friends, and she confronted the friend. Well, the friend told her, and then she called her the next day and said, I want to be clear, did this happen? And the friend told her that it, in fact, did happen, and she confronted Brad. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end. But there were many other issues, I think, based on or around surrounding control. If you look back again, that early transportation issue, that continued in a different way in that she was only allowed to have a certain amount of gas in her car, and the gas would only take her so far, and that Brad had cut her off from finances. His reasoning, and this is what he said in court documents, was that she was a spendthrift and that they were having financial problems and that he had to budget. And so he basically took her off all the bank accounts, all the credit cards. She had no access to money at all other than what he gave her. And so that limitation, again, limiting your transportation, limiting your finances. And then I think the next level was that he started to, according to her family and friends, they believed that he was monitoring her communications with them, looking at her email, also listening to phone calls, possibly even disconnecting phone calls. He was an expert in voice over internet technology, which is now much more common, but at that time, a couple of years ago, it was still kind of in its infancy in terms of being widely used. And he knew a lot about phones. He knew a lot about how computers and phones and how they worked, and the belief was that he was monitoring her phone calls. And then finally, I think the last straw in the whole control issue was that they were beginning to talk about divorce and custody issues. And they were still living in the home together because neither of them basically could really afford to not do that at that time. And they were trying to figure out what the next step was. And Nancy really wanted to go back to Canada to be with her family. And Nancy said, told her friends, and this was later confirmed, that he had taken the children's passports. So she was not able to leave the country. And so, again, really a lot of small things started out as small issues but turned into much bigger issues.
Yeah, certainly. The idea that he would take the passports, I understand he's a paranoid person that thinks that maybe his wife will take off. They're having arguments that she doesn't want to stay, so he takes the passports and he's doing all this monitoring. Seems to be at that time a very paranoid person, maybe even rightfully so, because she's telling him that she does not want this, doesn't want this anymore. That doesn't mean it's justifiable, but it sort of lends itself to his paranoia.
Absolutely. And there was also an issue of alimony. They, again, were in the beginning stages of talking about a separation agreement. And Nancy's lawyer had drafted a very early agreement, which is usually something that you then negotiate back and forth on for a while. But he had gotten a hold of that. Again, the belief is that he got into her email. And the alimony payments were high, and the belief was that he just didn't want to pay those alimony payments or the child support. And clearly she didn't work, and that was going to be part of the deal. If she went, wherever she went, whether she went to Canada or not, that was going to be part of the issue. So there was a lot of discussion during the trial and also during the custody battle about Brad's concern for his finances and how a divorce would ultimately have affected him financially.
Now, in terms of the two young girls, what was Brad like as a father, and was it more so just in keeping with the characteristic of control that he didn't want them to leave, or was he going to be a devastated father who was a good father? I mean, I know he was busy, so he wasn't as attentive as he could be, but what was he like as a father?
I think that there was a lot of controversy about that issue. I think that in many ways he was like many fathers in America, and that he worked long hours, and as a result, his wife was the primary caregiver for the children. That doesn't mean he didn't love his children. It just means that he wasn't present with them in the same way that she was, and as a result, the children had a much stronger bond with their mother than they did with their father. I think that people that saw Brad with the children, and if, for example, if they were at a party, Brad was not somebody that liked to socialize with adults or make chit-chat. That just wasn't his nature. And so a lot of times, Nancy, being the social one, would be talking to the adults, and Brad would be watching the children or playing with the children. And people did witness him playing with the children at the pool and in other settings. But there was also a lot of anecdotal evidence that he was absent for a lot of important things in their lives, be it doctor's appointments, things that happened at the preschool, any kind of, you know, events where they were performing, that Nancy was the one that was there. There's no doubt, I don't think, that he loved his children, but then there was also a question about the custody. And at one point, Nancy told friends that he had said, well, I'll take one child and you take the other, which I think for any of us that are parents, we couldn't even imagine. How could you even fathom that? And then there was some other discussion where Nancy had told friends that he had said, I want to spend time with the kids and then leave and don't ever come back, and I don't want to see you or the kids ever again. And who knows if that was said in anger or if that was something that he meant. But at the end of the day, I think the evidence simply was that he was an absent father, not necessarily that he was a bad father, but that he just wasn't present with his children. And he did, again, other than working many, many long hours, I mean, I think everybody agreed that he was a workaholic. I think he was also very involved in these Ironman triathlons, which for anybody that knows about the training for those, I mean, that's a 100-mile bike ride, a full marathon, a swim. I mean, it takes a lot of time to train for something like that. So between those two things, and he was getting his MBA, between those three things, he simply didn't have a lot of time to be a father.
Yeah, and like you say, because of these hobbies that take an incredible amount of time, and plus his work schedule, and there is some talk of infidelity as well. At least he's got these long hours. He's a busy guy outside of the family, and she's really stuck at home with the kids pretty well.
Absolutely.
Full time.
And there was also some testimony about the fact that Nancy had found a list under his keyboard of his computer, and she also showed it to some friends who verified after her death that this list existed. And basically the list had things that he had written down, like, so this child likes chicken nuggets, this child's favorite color is yellow, things that a good parent would not have to write down, that you would know these things about your own child. And so the thought was that he was preparing for the custody battle and was trying to memorize things about his kids. And so, you know, that was obviously a little unsettling for her when she found this and shared it with friends, saying, hey, I don't understand why any parent would have to, you know, wouldn't know what their kid's favorite food is and what their favorite color is and so on.
Yeah, interesting. Not that this is proof in itself of anything, but was there any conversations with Nancy and her parents or her family, her brother, or her sister, you know, identical twin, is there any conversations whatsoever about her being fearful that he may assault her, hurt her, stop her, or be violent in any way? Was there any conversations like that?
There were no conversations with her family to that end. And, in fact, even in the very final weeks when there were some desperate crying phone calls between Nancy and her parents and her sisters, they all asked her, and in fact her brother remembers asking her directly, are you afraid? Her father asked her directly, are you afraid? And Nancy Cooper was a very, in many ways, very strong, very opinionated, very confident woman. She had become broken in a way through this troubled marriage, but inherently her core was that she was somebody that didn't give up easily, that didn't, you know, take no for an answer, and that she was somehow, even though she had gotten very desperate and very distraught over the state of her marriage, was going to get through this. And I think it would have been very difficult for her to admit that she was afraid. On the contrary, there were several friends who testified that she told them that she did sleep sometimes with her door locked, with her jeans on or her, you know, street clothes on, and with her keys in her pocket, ready to go if she needed to go in the middle of the night, that she was afraid of Brad. Now, whether that was physically being afraid or just afraid that there was going to be a huge fight and that she would have to just run out and get in her car. The passports were also kept in the car prior to him taking them. So, again, that belief of I'm ready to go. My purse is in my car. My passports are in my car. My keys are in my pocket. My phone's, you know, on the nightstand next to me. I'm ready to go. But never were there any allegations of physical abuse prior to the murder.
Now let's get to 2008 and let's get to the just prior to this. And there's a person named Carrie Clark, Nancy's friend. And for the audience that may not know, Nancy did have, I don't know the degree of it, but she did have Crohn's disease.
Crohn's disease.
Okay. She did have Crohn's disease?
She did have Crohn's disease, which is, you know, an gastrointestinal issue. Some people, it can be very, very serious. Other people can have a mild case. Nancy had some serious bouts with it that took her to the emergency room, you know, dehydrated and not being able to keep any food down. But she became a runner, and the running seemed to really help kind of balance her system and her body. And so she really had become quite an avid runner prior to her death. And when she initially disappeared, you know, one of the first questions people had was, well, maybe she had some kind of an attack of Crohn's disease, and maybe she was lying on the side of the road or in the woods somewhere. And so her friend, the very first thing she did actually was call all the emergency rooms in the area to see if she had, you know, been admitted, had flagged a car down, and had maybe been had a bout with Crohn's disease. And of course,
a conversation, though, with Carrie that she didn't feel like running, either was the day before or that day, so there was some indication that she wasn't feeling well enough to jog? And then, of course,
I think that she had some, it had something more to do with muscular stuff. It was not about her Crohn's disease.
Right.
But yet she was supposed to run. She had a couple running partners, but she was supposed to run with this particular partner the day before, and they connected that morning at 5 or 5:30 and said, you know what, Nancy said, I'm not up to it today. So she didn't. Then the plan, according to her husband, was that she was going to run that Saturday morning. And so when Nancy didn't show up for some other plans with friends that day, Saturday, Brad said she had gone running and had not returned. And later, the woman that was her usual running partner, she testified that they did not have any plans to run on that Saturday and that she hadn't planned to see Nancy until at least Sunday or maybe the day after that. So there was some discrepancies in as far as what plans did she have, what plans did she not have. Her very close friend, Jessica Adam, testified that she had a plan to come to her house to help her paint because Nancy had been picking up extra jobs for a little money here and there, and one of the things that she could do was paint. And so she was helping her friend paint, I think it was her dining room. And so that was supposedly her plan for that Saturday, and she never showed up. And so that started the ball rolling of, okay, what's happened to Nancy? And her friend ultimately, after calling around, calling other friends, and calling the emergency rooms, she ultimately called the police, called 911, and said, you know, my friend is missing, and I don't know, but something may have happened to her. And so that was the beginning of the investigation. And really, that call, had that call not been made, it might have been many, many days before anybody found out what happened to Nancy Cooper.
Now tell us about what Brad Cooper does when he says, you know, I think my Nancy went for a jog and didn't come home. How many hours before he called anyone, and who did he call first, and what was his demeanor like, and what was the conversation?
She supposedly left the house. I think he testified that he heard her leave the house a little before 7. And then he had a tennis game at 9:30. He said he canceled his tennis game when Nancy didn't return, but it wasn't unusual for her to go for a long run and then have coffee. Again, not counting into the fact that she had this painting date with her friend, because he clearly didn't know about that plan. And then her friend started to call, and then another friend called. And so then, clearly, Brad realized that she had plans with other people. And so ultimately, he said, well, let me see if I can try to reach her running partner. Do you have her name? Do you have her number? He didn't have her number or her last name. And then eventually, around lunchtime on that Saturday, he threw the kids in the car and went driving around the area looking for her, and told Nancy's friends that that's what he was going to do. And part of that, he went to several neighborhoods, and he also went to the gym that they both belonged to, which was nearby, to see if she had checked in at the gym. The friends were getting impatient. He was not answering his cell phone, and so ultimately that's why Jessica Adam called 911, and then she met the police at the house. And by that time, Brad was coming back from, you know, allegedly going out and looking for her. And that's when the investigation started. And then, you know, hundreds of people came out for this search. It was a massive search. And in addition to the police search, which was going on by air, by helicopter, by boat, there's several lakes in this neighborhood. There were dogs on the ground, you know, sniffing the trails. It's a very wooded area with lots of trails. And then just hundreds of searchers, volunteers, looking for her. But ironically, none of them found her. She was found that Monday. So, again, she was reported missing Saturday. She was found Monday night about 3 miles from her home in an undeveloped subdivision, face down in a drainage ditch, partially clothed, in a jogging top. And she was found by a man walking his dogs. And so then it became a homicide investigation from that point on.
What was the cause of death?
It was very difficult to say, because she had decomposed. It was very hot. It's North Carolina, obviously. And we had had torrential rains for about 24 hours. But the autopsy results, the best, I don't want to say guess, because I don't think doctors guess, but their right. ultimate decision was that it was asphyxiation and that she had been strangled.
Right.
There were no other wounds on the body.
Now, when the search is called, and Brad, again, has to pretend that he knew nothing of this and he's totally surprised and he's shocked, what exactly is his demeanor? How does he behave in light of this incredible news and his search?
Yeah, it's interesting, because right away, the Cary police are very media-friendly, and right away they started having press conferences to update the public on what was going on and also to ask for people's help in this search. And, you know, Nancy's family immediately all came from Canada to participate in the search, but also to participate in this media attention that they were trying to get, which was, hey, please help us find our daughter. And so Brad was invited to these press conferences. He attended one, which was the evening press conference on that Monday night. The body was found several hours after this press conference, but this was around dinner time on that Monday night, which would have been July 14th, 2008. And he got up and he made a very, very brief statement where he just said, I want to thank everybody for your support, thank people for searching, and help me, you know, hopefully we'll find her. It was very quick. Again, he's very shy. He looks down. He's not somebody that is very outgoing or engaging in any way. And it was just very, very brief. And then that was his last appearance. And when we as journalists asked the police chief why he wasn't at subsequent press conferences, she basically said he'd been invited, but he had chose not to come. And They did say from the beginning that he was cooperating, but again, I think that that's more police speak, because at the time they didn't want to call him a suspect because they didn't have enough evidence to arrest him. And so they weren't calling him a suspect until his arrest, which was about 3.5 months after Nancy's body was found.
Now, you say too cooperative. I wanted to clarify that, too. What it was is that he didn't let the police go in and search high and low. He just, they were able to walk through. So he was, as you sort of allude to, he was somewhat cooperative, and then soon after, not cooperative at all.
Right. He shut down as soon as the body was found and hired a lawyer. And, I mean, we've seen this in a lot of national cases, and we've seen it in a lot of our local cases. He initially took them into the home, didn't let them walk around, but they didn't have a search warrant, and they didn't take anything out of the home. It wasn't a scientific search, if you will, or a search where they had gathered evidence. It was just, you know, hey, come on in, sit at the dining room table, and he did let them walk through the house. And then he, as soon as the body was found, that conversation with police ended, and he never spoke to them after that. There were many, many attempts by investigators to have him come down to the police station and answer questions. They even eventually, I think, gave questions to his attorney and asked him to answer those questions, which he did answer some of those, but very briefly. So it's like we've seen in many, many cases like this in domestic situations where the man immediately stops talking, or the spouse immediately stops talking to investigators. And most of us think, well, if your wife was murdered, wouldn't you want to know what was going on? I mean, wouldn't you be banging on the police station door saying, hey, what's going on with my wife's case? Have you found the murderer? And so when somebody doesn't do that, it's unusual. Although, again, his personality, very, very reserved, very quiet, not very outgoing. So it's kind of hard to tell, you know, what the impetus behind that was.
Now, before we get to the trial, like you say, he was arrested 3.5 months after police finally lay the charges. Nancy Cooper's family takes in Brad Cooper, this shy guy with not really close ties with his own family. When this occurs, when there's they've had the search, when they've located her body, she's been found dead and strangled, what kinds of conversations, if any, does he have with the parents? And what does he say if he does have a conversation with them?
Right. Absolutely no conversation. He never called her parents or any members of her family to say something's happened to Nancy. At one point, the identical twin sister, Krista, does call him when Nancy's missing and says, what have you done with her? Because she immediately assumes, as did others, that something had happened between them and he had done something, and he hung up on her. When the family comes, they have to have some interaction with him because of the two children. The children are being shuffled around with friends, and of course Nancy's family wants to have some time with the children. And so Brad at one point has to bring the children to the hotel where they're staying at, actually, so he could go to that press conference. And they said there was absolutely no conversation. No, I'm sorry, I'm worried, no hugs. And so the first real interaction that occurred happened at a prayer vigil at a local church. It was outside the church, and everybody was holding hands. And her mother, Donna Rentz, sees Brad, and you have to picture Donna. Donna's a very petite woman, and Brad is very tall and athletic. And she said she just decided to go up to him and to give him a hug. And she said he had a baseball hat on, and he leaned over, and she tried to look him in the eye as he leaned over to hug her. And she said the hug was very stiff and awkward, not like the times that she shared with him in the past, because she said she felt like he was her son. She treated him like a son, and she said he wouldn't look her in the eye. And she said at that moment, she said, I knew he killed my daughter. And so that was a very emotional moment for her to have those feelings so early on in the case, and then to have to live with those feelings for the next several years as the case worked its way through the system.
Now, he's charged with murder, but while this is going on, we've got a we can't forget about the two children, the two young girls. So a custody battle where the Nancy's parents are trying to gain custody of the children is raging while these charges and the preliminary is coming up.
Okay.
So while
pending,
this is all
right.
going on, there's a fierce custody battle as well.
Right. And again, I had mentioned that Gary Rentz had worked in child welfare in Canada, so he had some knowledge of how these things worked. So immediately within hours of Nancy's body being found, the wheels were turning, and Gary and Donna decided they were going to petition for custody of the girls. And so they got a lawyer. They actually hired the lawyer that Nancy had used for the divorce, was using for the divorce, and they filed an emergency petition to get custody of the girls. It was granted, and then they went, took the girls back to Canada. They came back for a hearing and were awarded temporary custody. This continued for several months, and what happened in those months was that there were hundreds and hundreds of pages filed in the public court record documenting the problems in this marriage. Many, many dozens of affidavits from friends and family members talking about all the problems that we've already discussed, the control issues, the financial issues, the infidelity. So whereas in most criminal investigations, the public and the media gets very little insight into what actually is going on here, we had this whole relationship kind of laid out for us in these custody documents. And then Brad Cooper did what most people would think is quite unheard of and probably not legally very smart, which is sitting for a 6.5-hour deposition in this custody case. And the belief of a lot of people is that that deposition gave investigators the fuel, if you will, because as we all know, if you are lying about something, it's hard to keep that straight, especially for 6.5 hours. And
sure.
You're going to mess up. There are going to be some pitfalls. And so as soon as that deposition was done, one of the investigators filed an affidavit that said the information in this deposition is inconsistent with what Brad Cooper has told us in the past. And he was arrested shortly after that, which was in late October of that year, 2008.
Very interesting.
So about 3.5 months after the murder.
Now, part of what took the police a little bit of time is because they need to have some concrete evidence. And as you talk about in the book, this is a circumstantial case. However, circumstantial evidence is seen by the judiciary very much like any kind of direct evidence or material evidence. It just has to be put together. What are a couple things? Like, we could talk about the missing shoes, and we could talk about the Google Map search. So tell us a little bit about some of the evidence that the police gathered that ends up being really, really important at trial.
Yeah, I think probably the biggest evidence in this case did surround computers and
right. Phones.
And all of the communications that today, you know, have become commonplace. I think that specifically the biggest piece of evidence that most people believe was the turning point in the case, it was a very long trial, it was 8 weeks long, and again, mostly a circumstantial case, was that investigators found a Google Map search on Brad Cooper's laptop computer that occurred at 1 o'clock that Friday. And remember, I don't know if I've mentioned it, but they were at a party that Friday night, and so
right.
She disappeared sometime after that party, before, you know, daylight the next day. And this Google Maps search was of the location where her body was found that following Monday. So the belief is that Brad Cooper is Googling the place that he's going to dump his wife's body 12 hours before she disappears. And so that was pretty definitive. It was a very short search. It was 40-some seconds, I believe, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 clicks of the mouse. But it was there. And so that was quite, I think, damning evidence. There was also some evidence, and he's this expert in phone technology, that he possibly made a call. He made his home phone call his cell phone that Saturday morning because he had to establish an alibi. And so he made 2 trips to the grocery store. and was caught on videotape both times at the grocery store, had receipts that were time-stamped to prove that he was there. And during one of those drives to the grocery store, there is a record of his home phone calling his cell phone. And so he used that to prove that Nancy was still alive at that time, that she was calling him to tell him to get something extra at the grocery store. And so there was a lot of evidence introduced about how all these he had all these calls routed to different locations, and that, you know, he had one call that went through some European number, and he had another call that went to a conference center in California, that he left a voicemail for himself in Europe. And so there were all sorts of strange things going on with his phone that morning as well. But again, that was still much more circumstantial, because part of that, to make that work, he had to have this special kind of router to make this phone call from the house work. And
right.
Didn't find that router. It was missing, but there was some evidence that he had had that specific router. So a lot of electronic evidence, I would say, was probably the biggest thing that brought this case together.
One of the other bits of evidence, too, was that they had him at Lowe's, I guess, department store, hardware store, buying a drop sheet. And, again, they very effectively at trial said he wasn't doing any painting.
They didn't
put the drop sheet where the painting was. So,
yeah, what he said was that he knew his wife was doing painting, so he was buying her a drop sheet. Of course, again, there was no evidence that he knew that she was going to paint that Saturday. In addition to that, there was some discussion about the fact that he didn't approve of her painting, because he didn't approve of her doing these things for extra money. And so they did find that drop cloth. It was not used. It was in the garage, still in the package. But he had told investigators that morning he was actually helping Nancy get the kids ready for preschool, when in fact he was buying the drop cloth. And one of the interesting things, we haven't really talked about this, of the two grocery store runs, they were 16 minutes apart. And so the thought was that if he did, as the state alleges, put her body in the trunk of his car and dump her in this location about 3 miles from their home, that he may have done that in between the grocery store runs. In the first video, he's wearing sneakers, running shoes. In the second video, he's wearing sandals. And so the thought is, why would you go home and change your shoes to go right back to the grocery store? He could have only been home, given the distance and the time, you know, a couple of minutes before he would have turned around. And the location where the body was found was completely just thick red mud. Again, we've had these torrential rains. So if he did go there in those sneakers, they would have had to have been thrown away, and those sneakers were never found. So
yeah,
that was another piece of circumstantial evidence. And then again, like I said, the infidelities, I think, was probably something that did sway the jurors, because they were hearing kind of this pattern of him, you know, just not really wanting to be in the marriage and not really being present in the marriage. And I think that, you know, lent itself to the circumstantial case.
Which what I found very interesting, too, is the makeup of the jury, that there was 10 women on that jury. So
and that's clearly, I mean, I think when you're dealing with a domestic violence case, which no doubt that's favorable to the state. It was interesting because I do go around and speak, and I think a lot of people don't understand our justice system and don't understand how it works. And in fact, I've had questions of, well, how is that fair? And I've tried to explain to them that both sides, attorneys on both sides, help pick that jury. And
that's
so they get to choose who's on that jury to a certain extent. They also get to challenge. They get a certain number of challenges to get people off the jury. And I think, unfortunately, what, you know, the belief may have been from the defense side, I mean, I don't know, they've never shared this with me, is that maybe some of these women had family members that had run-ins with the law. Maybe they were skeptical of authority, and I think it was just the opposite. I think they were women that maybe had some experiences with bad relationships and saw the case in a totally different light.
Well, they picked the best that they had to pick from, so there could have been a worse jury in their mind, I guess, based on there's so many reasons to eliminate somebody or want somebody not on that jury. So I just think that the state really made their case. I think they made a very compelling case. And even though it was, you know, it's kind of wonky scientific technology, you'd say, oh, that could be a problem. The state put out a pretty good case and explained things fairly simply. So I think that was to their benefit, definitely. I wanted to ask you, too, because I think that you've had a little bit of, well, you've had quite a bit of controversy over people like we talked about earlier before the interview about prejudging this case. And I think that is also stirred up by the defense attorneys grandstanding to assert or making statements to the effect that, well, we couldn't get our expert up there. Our expert would have proven that there was some tampering. And so a lot
of
conjecture.
And, you know, absolutely. And one little funny sidebar to that, Dan, is that expert that didn't get to testify actually came to my first book signing and bought 12 books for his family and had me sign them. So he wasn't upset. He's not that upset. It was just a job to him. But, you know, there is a lot of controversy. It's really interesting what we're seeing with this case and other cases like it. And I really strongly believe that, well, it's twofold. First of all, we're streaming these cases online. So for the first time ever, people, the courtrooms have always been open to the public, but people aren't going to go to the courtroom. Most people aren't. So for the first time ever, the public, wherever they are, North Carolina, California, Maryland, New York, Florida, can sit down and watch everything that goes on in the courtroom and be their own judge of what they believe to be the truth or not the truth. And in addition to that, the proliferation of social media, where anybody who has access to a computer can log on and say anything they want to say with no background in the law, with no background in the particular case that they're watching. I mean, again, they could be anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world. And so you do get these trial junkies, these people that are just obsessed with these cases, have no connection to Brad Cooper or the case, but just, you know, fall on one side or the other very strongly. And, you know, it's a very interesting debate because I think that it's going to be more and more difficult for judges to insulate juries specifically from this kind of stuff. You know, you can tell them not to watch the news. Well, the news is pretty benign, frankly. I mean, don't watch the news, don't look at the newspaper, don't look at news websites. Now they're starting to say, in fact, I'm covering another similar case right now, the judge is saying, don't Facebook. Don't Twitter. Don't do it on your phone. Don't do it on your computer. You have to insulate these juries if you're going to keep the justice system fair. So, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. I strongly believe that. But I also believe that just like you have a right to turn the channel, I have a right not to read your comments, and I don't. So, you know, not or respond. And, you know, that's America. It's the First Amendment. People can say whatever they want. And I think until we decide how we're going to rein that in on the Internet, I don't know if we ever will. I don't know that there's going to be a change. But I do think it's a challenge for the justice system. And in this case, we had a lawyer who was working for the defense in the courtroom who was on blogging and commenting on the case. And, you know, you can decide what you will. Is that illegal? Is that unethical? I think it may be a little bit of both, but especially if you're managing the conversation. So, you know, you have to look at the source. And again, everybody is entitled to their opinion, and they sure will share it, won't they?
Yeah, I think it's unethical because you have the arena where you can do what you want. But to go outside that arena and then cry that your expert wasn't accepted in court and make it sound like there was some conspiracy, the judge decided that this person wasn't an expert and wasn't qualified to be able to testify. And so if you have an issue with the judge, and then that defense attorney knows that he can file the necessary papers for that, and if he had any ethics, he would wait that out. Instead, he goes to the public domain. For what reason? I'm not sure. For further work or something, because it is conjecture. And some people don't take the time to look at the trial very carefully and then make a decision based on that emotional, you know, being stirred up emotionally. But I do agree with you. Now that this new era of this information being in real time and people be able to follow it, I think there is the ability for people to educate themselves with the trial process, because there's a lot
to know. Absolutely. And you know, so I think that there's a lot of value in that. At the same time, I think there's a danger of people that don't have a background in the law and don't really necessarily completely understand the system, putting out misinformation and things that could influence the case. Now, again, you hope that jurors are not paying attention to that, and they shouldn't be paying attention to that. And good jurors, which I believe most people who sit on a jury take it very seriously, will insulate themselves from that. But it's becoming harder and harder. I mean, I know when I first started in this business, jurors were literally sequestered. I mean, they were in a hotel room. And now states have decided that's too expensive. And even if you were to do that, you would have to take away their phones and computers. And I think very few people would sit on a jury with those kinds of rules. So, you know, it's a challenge to figure out how do you mix this new world with a justice system that is supposed to be unbiased.
Now, with this trial, there was almost 100 witnesses. It was well attended. Of course, the media was all over this thing. It was a huge story. In the end, of course, the defendant didn't take the stand in his own defense. What was the final outcome? Was the state successful?
The final outcome was that Brad Cooper was convicted of first-degree murder. He is now serving a life sentence. His lawyers have appealed that verdict, and so we'll know probably it can take many months,
sure,
to even a year, before the appeals court says we will or will not hear this case. So it will be a while before we have any information on that. But I think that there was some surprise in the verdict in that the jury was out for several days, and I think Nancy's family specifically was starting to feel like, you know, they weren't going to get a verdict, that it could end in a mistrial. They also had second-degree murder on the table, so they could have gone that direction.
Right.
But ultimately, they came back with the guilty verdict, and it was interesting, right after the verdict came down, none of the jurors wanted to talk. A lot of them were very emotional, as in many cases, it's a difficult thing. You're deciding about somebody's life. And
sure.
I recently had the opportunity to speak with the juror. She approached me at one of my book signings. She read the book, and she told me that there was never any dissension in the jury room. She said that they agreed from the very beginning that it was guilt, and that they just methodically went through the evidence to make sure that they were all on the same page with the degree. And they, in the end, felt very strongly that they had made the right decision. And so it was interesting to hear her perspective, you know, many months after the verdict had come down.
Certainly, and it gives you some vindication that you were on, that you handled this properly, because she did read the book, and you would have heard otherwise if she had any issues with your depiction of how this trial did go down.
Absolutely. And as you know, Dan, in a true crime, I mean, it's factual. So I'm telling the story basically from what happened. I mean, this is the public record. I shared the custody battle. I shared the press conferences. I shared the hearings, and then, of course, the trial. And so I can't change the outcome. I can't change the – it's not a murder mystery. It's not fiction. I can only write what happens. And the subjective – aspect comes in when you decide, you know, which interviews you're going to include. And of course, Nancy's family did do several interviews for the book, and so those are included in the book, and they basically talk about the fact that they believe that this was domestic abuse, and that they want other women who may be in this situation to use this story kind of as a cautionary tale and to reach out for help if they are in this situation. And, you know, a lot of women who are educated, who are professional, who are in upper middle class communities are ashamed to ask for help in these situations, because they don't have a broken arm or a black eye or a broken nose, which is what most of us think of domestic violence. And so therefore they think, well, I'm not really a victim. And, you know, the bottom line is they're in this situation were some red flags, a lot of red flags, according to family and friends, and other people may be in that same situation, and there doesn't have to be abuse before somebody's murdered. That can be the ultimate act of domestic violence.
Absolutely. Now, just for a little bit of a bright spot with this, you did talk about who the children live with. Now, tell us again who the children live with and sort of where they are now and what their life is like, if you know and have any indication.
Right. Well, the children were taken in by Nancy's family, and it was interesting because there was a lot of discussion because they already had a daughter who had a child, so she clearly knew how to be a mother, and then they had a son, the police officer, and he had several children. But they ended up with the sister who didn't have any children. In fact, she couldn't have any children, but had really bonded with Nancy's children and was especially
right.
close with the older daughter. And so she is the identical twin sister, and she took the children in, she and her husband, and they are being raised in Canada. And so the youngest child, in many ways, although they talk about Nancy and they tell her about Nancy, never missed a beat. I mean, she was only two, and she now
yeah.
has a mother who looks exactly like the mother
yeah.
that gave birth to her. So there is something special about that and the DNA kind of being shared. And
yeah.
I'm told they're doing very well. They have a big, loving, extended family and a lot of support. And so given the tragedy, it's the best possible situation.
Yeah, it's just a bit of a bright spot in what usually are sad stories, really. But, yeah, it's a little bit of a bright spot. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Amanda, for a great interview and about a fantastic book, Love Lies. And thank you very much for coming on this evening and talking about this
well, thanks,
book, and
Dan.
I really appreciate it.
So
I wish you the best of
always.
Luck. Well, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
We enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, and I'm sure the audience will respond with many, many listens to the program. So I want to thank you very much. For those people listening, the book that we were dealing with this evening is Love Lies by Amanda Lamb. Thank you very much, Amanda, and good night.
Thanks, Dan. Good night.
Good night.